Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry.
I'm Ben Jackson, in for Alyssa Milano, who's working outside of the country this week. It's hard to believe it, but we have to say this still in 2023. Across the nation, right-wing forces are banding together at all levels of government to ban access to books in schools and libraries. Florida, in particular, has been a hotbed of these bans under the dubious leadership of Ron DeSantis. Our guests this week are suing to make sure literature remains accessible. Nadine Fareed-Johnson serves as the managing director of Pan America Washington and Free Expression Programs, and Ashley Hope Perez is an author and educator whose novel Out of Darkness has been one of the most challenged books in the country during this onslaught of anti-speech actions.
Governor, here in Duval County, we have seen bookshelves in schools emptied in response to Florida's new guidelines on books.
Conservative Christian groups are working to take over the boards of public libraries. The state's attorney general has conducted a six-month investigation into what he called sexually explicit materials in libraries.
A Tennessee school board has banned the critically acclaimed graphic novel Mouse. It is a true story about the horrors of the Holocaust by Art Spiegelman, and it depicts Jews as mice and Nazis as cats.
The free speech group Pen America, along with Penguin, Random House, several authors, and a group of parents, filed a lawsuit against the Escambia County School District over what they say are First Amendment violations.
I am Nadine Fareed-Johnson, and I am working to stem the tide of censorship and defend freedom of expression.
I'm Ashley Hope Perez, and I'm an author fighting to stop right-wing groups from stripping libraries of books and resources.
Sorry, not sorry.
First, thank you both so much for being here. Nadine, I'd like to start with you. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about you and the work that you do with Pen America?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much again for having us on the show. So I am Nadine Fareed-Johnson. I am the managing director of Washington and Free Expression Programs at Pen America. Pen America is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that stands at the intersection of literature and human rights to protect free expression in the U.S. and around the globe. So our work focuses not only what's happening in the U.S., but also we work to protect writers and authors and others whose freedom of expression is hampered all around the world. In this space, we have been working for the past 2 years in particular to collect reports of what is really turning into a wave of educational censorship, largely focused on book bans, but also in other arenas. And we're working to stop that wave.
And I should say now, just for transparency, that I am a dues-paying member of Pen America, which I think is really important work. The work that you do is really critical. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. Why does the First Amendment work that Pen America is doing matter so much right now?
So I would actually say here, to give a little bit of a background, we are in the midst of what I would call the broadest attack on First Amendment rights in schools and universities that we have seen in generations in this country. Look, we have had periods of censorship, waves of efforts to curtail access to books. We saw it in the McCarthy era. We've seen it more recently in the 1970s and 80s. Basically, every 20 to 30 years, there is some kind of wave. And thankfully, at every turn, these efforts have ultimately failed, and the rights protected by the First Amendment have been preserved. But what we're seeing now is actually newer, and it's broader than what we've seen in the past, because the focus here has been on school libraries. And as Pen America has tracked over the past couple of years, we have over 2,500 book bans that have happened in 37 states across this country, affecting over 4 million students.
And I think Many people think that this is a problem that's limited to a handful of southern states. We hear about Ron DeSantis, maybe, or Greg Abbott in Texas or Tennessee, but it's really not, is it? It's much broader than that. You say 37 states. Where are some of the hotbeds of this?
We have seen a particular rise in book bans in Missouri. We've seen it in Pennsylvania. We've even seen in different pockets of states like Oregon. So it really is all across the country. And you're right, people do tend to think about it being in certain parts of the country. As you've noted, we've heard a lot about Florida, which is certainly a hotbed, which we can talk about. It's certainly not alone either.
And I want to come back to that in a minute about why this is happening and how it's happening in small pockets of places across the country where you might not expect it. But before we do that, I'd like to bring Ashley in. So Ashley, if you could just let us know a little bit about you and who you are and the work that you do.
So I am a novelist. I've written 3 novels, and I'm also a university professor. I teach world literature at The Ohio State University, and I'm a former public high school teacher. Often writers get asked, how did you start writing for young adults? And I, back in the early 2000s, was taking my students weekly to the library, and we had tons of conversations about the books that they wanted but couldn't find. And back in 2005, those books hadn't been written, books that centered students from Latinx, Black, Asian American experiences, those weren't on the shelves. And over the past couple of decades, writers like me have worked really hard, and we've made some modest but substantial progress. And we're really seeing such a big push to roll back that progress. And I come into it with multiple overlapping lenses. One, I'm an author who cares about what books are on the shelves when teachers, like the teacher I was, walk their classes into a school library. And I know that for young people, many young people who don't have a credit card to buy things online, who don't have bus fare to get to the public library, if it's not in the school library, it might as well not exist. And kids don't know what's not there. So the opportunities for young people to find the book that matters to them at that moment, to find the book that's a bridge. Often I think about my novel, Out of Darkness, as the kind of YA novel that is a bridge for young people to adult fiction, to other works of literature, because it's complex and challenging in ways that invites that kind of curiosity. You realize I can handle this kind of a book, and you're curious about what else is out there for you. But people don't know to look for something that they don't know is missing from their library.
And that's something that school librarians have been so important in, right? Is that building these curated collections of works that maybe challenge biases or assumptions that students would have just based on where they live and what their community is like, and expose them to ideas that are different than themselves. And removing that ability from the librarian to do that creates a persistent and limiting mindset for these kids, right?
Absolutely. And I think that what initially this really looked like using the books as symbols, but I think that the right-wing groups have been successful beyond their wildest dreams.
I'm just thankful that y'all don't have the ability to make a mask mandate. And tonight I was going to talk about the need for a second high school, but I was sidetracked by, for the boys, pussy or the idea of pussy or the idea of pussy. A Mexican is a Mexican is a Mexican. Take her out back, we boys figured, then hand on the titties. Put it in her coin box, put it in her cornhole, grab a hold of that braid, rub that calico. You can find that on page 39 of the book called Out of Darkness, which you can find at Hudson Bend Middle School and Bee Cave Middle School. All right, not gonna lie, I had to Google cornhole because I have the game in the back of my yard.
And now it's really turned into a much broader strategy focused on limiting literary imagination, limiting what kids can imagine as possible, and particularly for marginalized youth, particularly for queer kids in unwelcoming spaces where they're trying to survive 4 more years where they are. The ability to envision life where who they are is not only acceptable, but celebrated, where family and connection and community awaits them, is incredibly important. And the targeting of books about queer and non-white youth, it really hampers that work of imagining, which is, of course, affecting those kids. But I often, because the suburbs are whiter than a lot of parts of America,
I often stress, please don't imagine that these books are only important for students who share those identities. This is how young people imagine their peers more broadly. They see a world that reflects or challenges what they've known. And in order to be prepared, and this is where I come at it from my stance as a university professor, I'm like, hey, do you want your kids to be prepared to succeed at the flagship universities in your state? They need the experience of encountering other lives, and they need encounters with complex literary works. So stripping libraries of those resources is impairing the educational prospects of all students, including students whose identities are often centered in works of literature.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Well, let's talk about that in the context of your work. You mentioned your novel, Out of Darkness, is one of the most challenged books in the country. You mentioned the idea of the symbol of the book versus the reality of the ban. And if you could just talk about those bans and sort of both aspects, what are the reasons that people are saying your book is being banned for, or removed from collections for, and what's really going on behind that?
The folks who are pushing these book removals know to focus on quote unquote sexual content. They've mischaracterized the works of literature that deal in some way with sexual experience as pornography, as obscene. What bears noting is that even in the most conservative states, the definition of obscenity or pornography excludes works with literary, artistic, scientific, or political value. Those works cannot be obscene. So even a book like Out of Darkness, which does deal with sexual assault, sexual abuse, there's a healthy romantic relationship, which is very important to other trauma survivors to see someone who's experienced that kind of harm have a healthy and affirming relationship. Those elements in the context of a literary whole cannot be obscene, but that's often what folks focus on. What's interesting about the books that are targeted, as a former high school teacher and as someone who works in the world of young adult literature, I can tell you, in any space, not just the YA books, in any library space, if you stack up the books with sexual content, the stack that will be tallest, the stack that will have piles and piles, is about white, middle-class, straight people. But those are not the books that get removed. So what we know is that the sexual content is a pretext. And even these sort of like back channel spaces that are sometimes used or often used by right-wing groups, I think it was in Missouri, actually, there was a Facebook post that someone sent to me where they're explicitly saying, don't talk about race, don't talk about gender identity or gay people, just focus on the sex. If you have to tell people that, it's because that's not actually their primary concern. It's a strategy.
In support of everything Ashley just said, I think it's really important first to look at the fact that this strategy has morphed over the past couple of years. When we first started tracking these bans, what we saw was, by and large, they were focusing on books that had characters of color and that were about race or race relations or racism. And if you recall, a lot of this came from, a lot of this started talking about CRT, and then people saying, oh, we don't teach CRT. Was that really actually the point here? The point is that you are trying to erase information about history, and you are trying to ensure that students do not have access to books that talk about these challenging issues.
I guess we live in a world now that our public schools would rather have kids read about gay pornography than Christ.
The main characters of 33 Snowfish include a 10-year-old boy who is sexually abused by a man who exploits him. This novel made the American Library Association's list of best books for young adults back in 2004.
and also that are demonstrating people in different situations. And to Ashley's point, not only allowing kids to see themselves in these books, but also creating empathy in other students and having them be part and parcel of the community around them. I think it's also really important to think about this from the point of that the books that we are seeing on these lists that are being circulated that have led to a lot of the removals and restrictions are books that were put in place on purpose by librarians in order to help the communities that they're serving, because librarians have the expertise, they have the education, they understand what these books are made for, whom they are designed. There's an entire framework from publishers, Ashley can tell you about this, that they know this is book for 4 to 8 year olds, this book is meant for 8 to 12 year olds. And we also know that kids don't always fit very neatly in those frames. You know, you can have a kid who really loves graphic novels at the age of 17 and one who really likes from the age of 8. And we just have to think about what is best for the individual kids. Which brings me to the point about parents. A lot of this is being driven, as we know, by groups like Monster Liberty, who talk about this from a parental aspect. They are not the only parents. As a parent, I am obviously really involved in my kids' education. I check their backpacks, and not only for the random sandwich that was left and that shouldn't have been in the backpack, right? I'm checking here, what are they reading? What are they learning? I engage with their teachers. What we hear a lot from these groups is one of the taglines is, we don't co-parent with the government. But when what you're doing is actually enlisting the government to act as a proxy on your behalf and censor access to materials for an entire community, you are indeed co-parenting with the government, and you are doing so in a way that allows the government to undermine the First Amendment rights of people in the community. And that's exactly what PEN America has been working toward and why we ultimately brought this lawsuit as well.
Yeah, not co-parenting with the government. You're not only co-parenting with the government, monitoring the government's saying, hey, government, I don't want you to allow my kid to have these things, but you are attempting to co-parent everybody else's kids. School leaders confusing the loudest, shrillest voices in the school board meeting with the community, imagining that those folks somehow speak for the community, and it is just overwhelmingly been demonstrated not to be true. Most Americans do not support book banning, and that includes Republicans.
I want to talk a little bit about Moms for Liberty, because first of all, I can't imagine that there's a more ironically named group in the country. Because exactly of what you're speaking, that they in fact are working to restrict freedoms of everybody, including themselves and their own families, but everyone who doesn't think exactly like them and who doesn't live exactly like them.
Moms for Liberty, part of a study of hate and extremist groups by civil rights watchdog Southern Poverty Law Center.
And it's quite remarkable because you look at the list, and I think the first guy on there is a legitimate Nazi with holding up Nazi flags, giving a high Hitler sign.
The group started in Brevard by pushing back against COVID mask and vaccine policies in public schools.
But what they're doing and what scares me a little bit about them is that they are focusing on local governmental races, right? School boards, town councils, in places where they can be very effective and in places where they are very often unchallenged in their electoral work, right? And so you end up in places that you might not expect to have situations like this with very sort of harmful school boards, for example. And I just want to talk a little bit about what that strategy is like, what impact it's having, and how we might go about countering that. Nadine, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. I think it's critically important to recognize here that irrespective of how these folks get into these positions on the school boards, the bottom line from a free expression perspective and from a constitutional perspective is that if you are in a official position and you are part of the government may not restrict access to a book based on having a problem with the ideas or other information in the book, right? You cannot restrict access to information based on content that is viewpoint discrimination. I think you're right that what we're seeing here is it is local. And what we would do actually is encourage people to be part and parcel of that civic voice in their communities. I think it's critical to recognize that, as Ashley points out, the loudest voice is not always the one representing the most individuals. And it's important to recognize that there are a number of parents in these communities who do not agree with this approach, who do not want their children not having access to these books. And more importantly, even if it's not about a particular book, it's about the idea that the government's going to come in and say, no, you cannot have this book as being part of the school library. I think awareness is important. I think recognizing what is happening in the community, being part of that community and engaging are all critical to countering this.
One pattern I think that PEN America has documented, and I've certainly seen in terms of where Out of Darkness, my highly banned novel, has been removed, is suburbs.
I'm not an advocate of censoring quickly anything, but these books are different because we're talking about a school library where there are minors involved. My name is Mary Ellen Cusella. I'm a mother of three teenagers. I'm working on helping the school district remove vulgar books from our school libraries.
Mary Ellen has become a crusader of sorts in the suburban town of Katy, Texas. She's had success removing books that she believes contain inappropriate content for minors.
It's not just the suburbs. And one of the things that I've been trying to frame for folks is how what happens in the suburbs has implications for urban spaces and rural spaces. And real quick, in a nutshell, I would say the suburban spaces are where books initially were being used as proxies for identities that white, often more conservative, often moms, were feeling uncomfortable about whose stories and whose lives were becoming more visible in their communities. And showing up, waving around books like Out of Darkness, which has a Black character and Latina on the cover, and saying this is filth was one way of signaling, not too subtly, like who they thought ought to be at the center of conversations and who they were angry about seeing centered or even included. And what I would say is that's also a factor because in the suburbs, you have parents who have the time and resources to relentlessly harass school board leaders, librarians, and school leaders. And that really started in Central Texas as a pattern setting thing, but we've seen it across the country in the suburbs. Really quick about what does it look like in the cities and in rural spaces, I would say as someone who grew up in rural East Texas, what happens is that what those official removals in the suburbs validate quiet removals in the rural spaces where there's much more conservative perspective overall. So those aren't even official removals because that kind of stuff is happening more subtly. But what happens in the suburbs validates school principals' sort of pressure to a librarian to just, I want you to put these in the back room. And in urban spaces, what we see is people coming in from the suburbs who do not have kids in the districts. So in Columbus, Ohio, for example, coming and harassing spaces where there's a drag story hour or filing challenges in a district where people do not even have children. So Columbus, Ohio, super liberal city overall, we have book challenges that have been initiated by folks in Columbus suburbs.
So you have a sort of a bleed of almost the not in my backyard mentality, moving from places with backyards to places without perhaps backyards. And it's really damaging. It's really damaging because it impacts so much more than just the immediate access to one particular book, but it's a cumulative effect of what people don't experience over a period of time when they're building their curiosity and their social literacy and all of the other things that happen.
I mean, I have a personal sense of what it means, not just for Out of Darkness to not be on the shelf, but to think about the student for whom genderqueer is a vision of non-binary experience and a livable life, right? Not finding that book. So there is a way it's both about specific encounters, but we're also thinking about what is the cumulative impact of not just which books are being removed, but which books are never purchased in the first place. And being here at the American Library Association and my panel on responding to book banning, I mean, one of the things that I'm just imploring librarians to do is to keep buying the books that serve their communities and document their merit. Because if you can say, this is how it serves my community, and these are the merits of this book, doesn't mean that these processes don't unfold the way that they do, but it is taking a firm stand for the rights of readers. I think that is so essential. What we have seen, even with the amazing partnership of PEN America and bringing the lawsuit in Escambia in Florida, the legal process is so slow. And with so many communities already physically removing books and then restricting librarians' ability to purchase, a child's entire high school education could play out with a school library that's been stripped of resources. In Texas, there are teachers who have simply been unable to have a classroom library at all.
In Florida, take a look at this packed event hosted by a bookstore. It's not a book signing. People that were there last night to support former National Youth Poet Laureate Amanda Gorman, who donated 1,200 books to be given out, including 400 copies of her book and two other titles restricted at a Miami-Dade County public school for kindergarten through eighth graders. The books are being restricted after one parent's complaint. Gorman's book is titled The Hill We Climb. It's the same title as the poem she read at President Biden's inauguration in 2021 as the youngest inaugural poet in U.S. history. Months later, her book was published and had been available at the school library for all students until one parent's complaint, and by the way, that parent did not actually read the book. Now the school district says only middle school students have access to Amanda Gorman's book. The parent's complaint stated it includes, quote, hate messages.
And you talk about the place where kids actually touch the books and think about, well, hey, maybe I'll try this one. Or the kids pass things around. No classroom library or no room to curate your own classroom library. Again, we're talking about a really impoverished educational experience. And that's the kind of thing that just pushes kids towards other media that are far less curated than school libraries. And so I feel like one thing that I just think underscores the degree to which this is disingenuous, that this is not about students and care for, you know, their safety or their well-being, is that the vast majority of kids have a cell phone in their pocket. And if their phone has amazing and effective restrictions, their buddy on the soccer team or their best friend, their phone doesn't. The idea that school library materials are what we need to focus on if we're concerned about pornography is absurd. I find that just the absolute reality that every parent knows. And so I'm thinking these parents are not really about, quote unquote, protecting young people. And last thing I would like to say is that to imagine that removing a representation of a painful experience like sexual assault somehow protects people, those experiences are still unfolding in young people's lives in the actual world. Removing the representation only removes the opportunity to talk about it, to have the language to name it. And that is something that, as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, I wish I had a book that helped me talk to my parents about what had happened to me. And it wasn't there. Those materials weren't there. So I think that the language of protecting young people is so disingenuous. I've been in Utah, for example, in a district where the obsession with removing books, there's Davis County is the district, floored me because it was unfolding at the same time as there was an FBI investigation of the suicide of a fifth grade Black student that found a pattern of unaddressed racism. And I am unable to fathom focusing on books that for these folks somehow seemed problematic because they included experiences that they didn't want young people to think about, like suicide, at the same time that a real child's life was lost. So I cannot imagine what does it mean to make that choice and what kind of disregard it shows for actual children.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about right now the leading cause of death for children and teens in America is gun violence. Kids die from guns. So I just have to ask you, Ashley, how many kids have your books killed in the past year?
Zero.
None. And so this is where we get to the idea of disingenuous, because very often these are the same people who are promoting access to guns, right? When you look in the elected officials, they're increasing access to the things that are harming children while restricting the access to things that give them the ability and the mindset and the connections to move past things that may be traumatic or real or happening in their lives. And banning genderqueer is not going to get rid of non-binary kids. It's just going to harm them, which is why I think this whole language is disingenuous around protecting kids, because they're not protecting kids. They're trying to erase kids that they don't like. But what I think is really dangerous about it, beyond what it does to the kids, is that to somebody in the community who may not be as engaged in the political discourse, that may just hear, I'm running for school board because I want to protect our children against these things, which I am scared of, is a really effective political message. And I wonder if either of you have ideas on how we might counter that for those people who may not hear this podcast or may not watch a couple of hours of cable news or turn on NPR or listen to their local librarian, right? How do we combat this in the community at sort of a grassroots level?
I will say a couple of things. I think you are absolutely right that this is stemming from, and it's fomenting and fostering a culture of fear, one that is othering, it is dismissive, and ultimately, as you note, is disingenuous because we know that kids have access to all kinds of information. And if they get at that access and it's not in the context of learning from a librarian or a teacher, then they actually don't have the tools to be able to deal with it. Whereas if someone in their school who is a trusted educator can help them through it, along with a parent, of course, doesn't have to be either or, but this understanding that if we erase, if we don't talk about, it's not going to happen, or these individuals will not continue to exist or not have the resources they need, is actually incredibly harmful. So I think one of the things is to note that fact. And the other is really to be part and parcel of the community. What I think we see here with this lawsuit, for example, is that it really does take a lot of courage for parents who do not agree with this to stand up and face this and talk about it. Often people get swept up in it. And these people, you see at the grocery store, you see them at PTA meetings, you see them out and about at soccer games, what have you. And so I do think it's important that people in the communities know that they are supported, right? And that students know they are supported, and libraries and teachers as well. One of the things that we are also concerned about with this is this self-censorship, where maybe a librarian won't select the book, maybe a publisher won't publish the book, maybe a writer won't write the book that they needed when they were a kid and that they have inside them to be able to provide that they wish they had, but now they might not do it because of what we're seeing. And I think that is actually, from the perspective of a literary and human rights organization, one of the biggest travesties of all of this is that this could lead to, and we already think we already have, led to some self-censorship. And I think it's important people know that they are supported. The other thing I will say, Ashley's made a really strong point about the sphere and about the erasure and about understanding what books can do for someone, right? Having them see themselves, having them learn about others, having them imagine. This kind of censorship that we're seeing when you deny people access to information, when you deny people access to literature, and you try to close off their world, that's an authoritarian tactic.
Breaking news overnight, an American reporter for the Wall Street Journal has been arrested in Russia. He's now facing 20 years in prison.
Evan Gershkovich was arrested by Russia's domestic intelligence service, the FSB, in the city of Yekaterinburg, which is about 800 miles east of Moscow. The FSB, as far as we know, grabbed Evan when he was in a cafe. He was taken from Yekaterinburg to Moscow, where he was brought before a court in Moscow to a closed hearing. And the only thing we were able to see, we saw a glimpse of Evan being brought out by officers with a hood pulled up over his head and with a hand on the back of his neck.
We see it happening all over the world. That's what Penn fights across the globe, when we have people who are deemed political prisoners because they wrote a book that someone who is in an official capacity didn't like. I'm not trying to overstate it, but I do think it's critically important to recognize that this is an approach that we see that does not lead to positive things, particularly when we're trying to, as our Supreme Court has said, build in our schools the effort to prepare students for life in a pluralistic democracy.
The one thing that sort of gives me hope in these situations is I think back at the early 1990s and the Velvet Revolution in the Czech Republic, when you had these sort of similar authoritarian restrictions on speech. And in this sort of bloodless revolution, the Czech people elected a poet who had been incarcerated, Václav Havel, as their president for many years. And so there is precedent for pushback on this that I hope we will see in this country. And I think we did, in fact, see that in 2004, when the right was doing something very similar with marriage equality and putting marriage equality amendments on ballots. And they won for a very short period of time. And then shortly thereafter saw that collapse underneath them. And they did it as an intentional electoral disingenuous movement, which they're doing now. But I do want to talk a little bit, Nadine, about the lawsuit that you have, because you mentioned that Penn America, along with authors and some parents, are suing a county in Florida over these book bans. Tell us about the lawsuit, what's going on, how that's moving along.
Yes, sure. So Escambia County School District and School Board in Escambia County, Florida, it's in the Pensacola region, they removed books from school libraries specifically because the books addressed issues of race and racism and LGBTQ plus identities. When they did that, they overstepped clear constitutional limits. We've discussed the fact that an official cannot remove a book because they don't like what's in it. And so Penn America, joined by two parents in the district who are suing on behalf of themselves and on their minor children who are in the district, and five incredible authors, including Ashley and Penguin Random House, who came in as a publisher, put its weight behind this. We sued to stop this. And our lawsuit focuses on the First and 14th Amendments. And all we're asking is the book get put back on the shelves, because what we're seeing is, again, it's a constitutional violation and we're working to stop it.
Ashley, as being part of that, tell us how you got involved and what it means to you.
Penn America has been a partner with me since my book was banned the first time in 2021. And I told folks over and over, Were it not for PEN America providing resources, providing opportunities for me to address the issues publicly, providing a framework for advocacy, my kids have seen me cry a lot of times, but I probably would have done nothing but cry. And instead, I've been able to be out there and advocate. And so when PEN America invited me to be a part of the lawsuit, there was absolutely no question in my mind that that was something that I wanted to do. It's something I want my kids to see me do. And I also am very aware that the people who are taking on the greatest personal risk in doing that are the parents, because it is a community in which taking that kind of stand may mean fewer people come to buy insurance from you if you're an insurance broker or whatever. I'm not sure what the professions of these folks are. It's not easy, right? It's not easy to take that kind of a stand in your own community. And so for me, my sense of it, and I feel this way in terms of there are some authors for whom that's the case because of their positionality, because of their financial situation. I can do it. I can be a part of this and manage the personal cost. And I want to do it. It's incredibly exciting to see an opportunity to push back. And one of the things I'm very proud of in this lawsuit is how clear and accessible, for example, the complaint is, the brief that was filed really provides a very clear analysis, it's almost a public-facing document in some ways to help folks understand what are the dynamics. In that document, we really stress the degree to which not only are these removals unconstitutional because they're targeting specific ideas that are not favored by folks on the school board, but they have repeatedly ignored the recommendations of the reviews that their district put together, following their own process, disregarding that repeatedly, and each time siding with the opinion of the person who brought the challenge, who happens to hold the same views as that school board or school board leader. That's highly problematic and it's blatant, right? So Escambia is especially egregious, but for folks to understand that similar things are playing out across the country, we can't bring a lawsuit in every district, but that this is one that really we hope will provide a clear signal that these actions and these infringements on students and families' rights will not go unaddressed. The last thing I want to say is just how excited I am that Penguin Random House joined. My next two novels are with Dutton, imprint of Penguin Random House. And I think that as the largest publisher in the world, for Penguin Random House to step in, it sends a signal to the industry. And Nadine earlier talked about the chilling effect. It is so real. There are authors whose works have been banned and multiple school districts, maybe dozens of school districts, who've never been on NPR to be interviewed about the impacts of that. So they're experiencing all the negative consequences, their books disappearing, that kind of a red mark by their name that makes educational publishers worried about, will this book be purchased or will this author's next book be purchased in a school market? That affects what's your next book deal. And so for Penguin Random House to show up publicly in support of the lawsuit, I think is helpful in setting a stand that other publishers see. And they want to be on the right side too, I hope.
Turning now to Florida, the largest publisher in the country, along with a group of authors and parents, are now suing a school district in the state to prevent it from banning books.
The federal lawsuit targets Escambia County School District and its school board. The plaintiffs accuse them of unconstitutionally removing books that mention race and LGBTQ plus identities.
And I will say, Alyssa's memoir was also published with Dutton, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And we're also really pleased that PRH is joining that particular suit. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this suit is in federal court. Is that right, as opposed to state court?
That's correct. Yes.
So this could have actually implications reaching beyond this particular county. So a decision here may, in fact, stand for a particular district of the country. But as we said previously, these book bans are happening across the country. And I'm curious if there are plans for additional lawsuits in additional districts to try and stem the tide of this, or what else is being done on a sort of a national or a grassroots level to fight these book bans as they are happening.
So right now we are focused, in terms of litigation, we're focused on Escambia County, which really is an epicenter of the attacks on the freedom to read that we have seen. But as Ashley notes, and we've talked about, this is happening all over the country, and it's happening in a very similar way, where you have one or two people who will file hundreds of challenges to books and admit they haven't even read the book. And they'll say this book is wrong or indecent or what have you, without even really having the full context or understanding the pedagogical use for the book. So it is something that really is a symbol of what's happening all across the country. We are continuing to document what is happening. We are continuously hearing from librarians, from school teachers, from parents, and from students who cannot access information. And so we are obviously taking a look at what's happening all over the country. We are continuing to support authors and to support librarian students and teachers in these different districts. And we're just going to keep going. I think that the point about authors and what I really want to come back to, because in looking at this, I mean, we work as much as we can to support writers who are facing this. Our reporting, when we looked at the last school year, we're still in the midst of looking at the one that just completed. But in the last school year, some 1,500 people, their livelihoods were affected by this. You have translators, you have illustrators, you have writers. Oftentimes, these are people who this is their first book. And I think that's another angle of this we really need to address, because it is cutting at the heart of what these people are doing for a living. It's stigmatizing the work that they do. It creates a stigma for the children who want to actually access the books. It's one thing we talk about in our complaint. And it also can be harmful to the parents who do not agree with this approach to this heavy-handed government censorship.
Now, one thing that I think the opposing side often does is it focuses on a particular outlier of books, maybe an extreme book, to use as a stand-in for a larger cross-section. And when I was coming up, there was a lot of talk about the Anarchist Cookbook and whether that should be available, right? Or there was Madonna's Sex Folio book. And people used that as a stand-in for why there needed to be regulation on what books were made available and oversight on what books were made available in schools and public libraries and whatnot. And so I guess I'll ask you, just as an answer to that, are there books which should be restricted from school libraries or public libraries in any way, shape, or form? And how do you go about addressing that if there are?
Our approach to this is to say, look, we have libraries in this country where Mein Kampf is available. We have libraries where the Communist Manifesto is available. We have libraries where Judy Blume's Forever is available, which was the one that was really the one when I was growing up. And it actually is still, to this day, being banned. And we would say, for all of these books, the answer is not removal. The answer is discussion. The answer is discourse. The answer is context. The answer is understanding. That's what we need. I want to be very clear that if there are book bans happening from a different political perspective, this is not about political perspective. This is about what our rights are in a pluralistic democracy. And we would seek to counter any kind of ban that was happening, irrespective of a political viewpoint. The point is that we already have a system in place. We have processes in place. That's in order to something they have been blatantly disregarded and then changed in order to satisfy some kind of a predetermined end. Ultimately, the importance is access to information. It is that context. And it is the freedom to read at base. And that's what we really want to be seeking to protect.
And I would say, this hasn't come up in this conversation, but a way that this is often brought up is both sides are doing it.
Are you a partisan, or are you just interested in free expression on, you know, across the political spectrum?
So we are a nonpartisan organization, and we have engaged in a lot of defense of people from both sides of the aisle, from our campus free speech to looking at protest rights. We are definitely engaged on this from a nonpartisan perspective.
And the example that folks will raise is a case in California where a group of parents sought to have To Kill a Mockingbird no longer used as part of the classroom curriculum, like a required text. And one of my points is, as a teacher, we revise our curriculum and we do that in ways we hope, I would hope, that are culturally responsive. And so one of the things, and I mean, this is one of the problems with To Kill a Mockingbird, is it, on the one hand, it reflects a cultural moment, but it does so very much from the perspective of the white experience of racial tension, right? And to make that the centerpiece of curriculum is probably not the best choice. Now, in those schools where they made a change and they said, okay, maybe we don't need to make that a required text in our curriculum, that book did not stop being available in the school library. So it's a very different situation. And I always stress the idea that if a book has been collected in a community and the librarian thinks it's serving the community, it's serving someone in their community, then whether I prefer it or not, it's not about removal. I can suggest, hey, can this context be provided? Or even with something like Huckleberry Finn, I don't to see that book removed from school libraries. If folks want students to understand what are the problems, why is it an issue for some people that the N-word is used hundreds of times in this book? And what are the ways of reading it responsibly? That can be really helpful context. The idea that there's anything comparable that has ever happened for the Seuss Foundation, for example, to choose not to reissue a book that had problematic stereotypes. That is not book banning. That is a decision.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a social and a business decision that a corporation made, right? It's very different.
But we would say that the right approach, we can disagree about training materials, but when you have a removal, when you have, and now we're seeing legislated bans that are coming out where states are taking that banner, and now we're having situations in which legislation is coming forward and saying, you may not discuss this topic, you may not have this major if it's a university, you may not have these discussions in class. That's an incredibly dangerous path and should be for anyone, no matter their political persuasion. And again, it is not about removing. It is about understanding. And again, this comes back to the point about everyone having a phone in their pocket. Do you want to be reading this on some website, or do you want to be learning it in the context of a classroom or with a school librarian in an educational setting where you actually can gain the context that will make you better informed and have you have an understanding that you can then carry forward in your rest of your studies, right?
Then I think what I'll ask then now for each of you, and this is how we close out each of our interviews, is starting with Nadine, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope are the people with whom we interact every day who are wanting to fight this. Whether they are authors like Ashley, whether they are school librarians who are standing up despite the enormous pressure put on them and saying, this isn't right. Whether it's teachers saying, I want to find a way to make sure my students are learning, whether it's the students who say, I want access to this information, or the parents who are, again, in these communities and taking the brunt of this every day, being local and saying, enough and not in our name. I think that's what gives me hope. We are incredibly privileged to work across wide swaths of people in these communities. I've actually heard from individuals all across the world. You mentioned Czechia earlier. I spoke with a reporter in Czechia for their public broadcast talking about the same kind of thing and how there is hope. And we've seen this happening. And again, the fact in the history that I mentioned at the outset, which is we have seen this happen time and again in our country. The first book ban that I was able to find was 1637. So we go back a long way in this realm. But every time we've come back, every time we've come back stronger, every time our rights have been reaffirmed, and that's what we're going to be doing here again.
I'd say that young people give me hope. I've been teaching, I'm thinking about my own children, like imagining the way that they understand their peers, the way that they support other people and loving whomever they love and dressing how they dress. They don't want others squeezed into boxes that won't allow them to thrive. That's true of my children, and I see it with my students. And I think I've been teaching since 2004. So a long time. And just seeing the progression from tolerance of difference to inclusion to like a fuller sense of not just, oh, okay, I can be all right with your differences, but a sense of what are the incredible resources and someone else's life experience can bring to the world and how do I hold space for them? That's where I see a lot more of my students now, and I'm very proud and excited about it. My middle name is Hope. I feel like I have been raised to be an optimist. However, I have never been more discouraged. And I feel like that thing, you know, I want to say that gives me hope. But what I am afraid of is that the framework for democracy, that what we have that has already been aggressively undermined, which has never been intended to really include everyone, that even that framework will be dismantled before the young people who have grown up with the capacity to include and be curious about others have the chance to be the leaders.
And I think that would be incredibly hopeful as well for all of us to see something like that come together. Nadine Farid-Johnson and Ashley Hope Perez, you both give us hope. Thank you so much for all that you do and for being part of the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Today, PEN America filed a lawsuit in Escambia County, Florida, challenging an egregious pattern of book bans. We're working with a group of authors, parents, and students to push back under the Constitution, the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment, because these bans run counter to our commitment to freedom of speech here in the United States. They're denying children the freedom to read, to learn, and it is important that a court step in and put these books back on the shelf.
There's a famous scene in George Orwell's 1984 in which Winston Smith finds a photo depicting executed politicians in a place where the government insisted they had not been. In all official records, this photo had been edited to remove these now-dead former leaders. The official position of the government was to remove elements of the past it found distasteful in an attempt to control the population by controlling the information to which it had access. This is, in a very real way, what people like DeSantis and the incredibly ironically named Moms for Liberty groups are doing to our country. By removing access to writing about our culture, both in the present and in the past, they can shape a future narrative of an America that never existed, an America which aligns with their broken and dangerous worldviews. We can't let it happen. Erasing depictions of life does not, in fact, erase the reality of our story. It simply restricts our freedoms. You can't be pro-freedom and support these anti-freedom actions. They're mutually exclusive. If, like me, you want to fight these efforts, I urge you to join PEN America. They are on the front lines of our free speech, and they need your help.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.